From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
By January 15th, 2021, our forces, their size in Afghanistan, will be 2,500 troops. Our force size in Iraq will also be 2,500 by that same date.
That was Chris Miller, the U.S.'s acting Secretary of Defense, speaking on Tuesday.
This is consistent with our established plans and strategic objectives, supported by the American people, and does not equate to a change in U.S. policy or objectives. Moreover, this decision by the President is based on continuous engagement with his National Security Cabinet over the past several months, including ongoing discussions with me and my colleagues across the United States government. And just this morning, I spoke with key leaders in Congress, as well as our allies and partners abroad, to update them on these plans in light of our shared approach. We went in together, we adjust together, and when the time is right, we will leave together. One of my calls was to NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg. Another was to Afghanistan's President Ghani. We will finish this generational war and bring our men and women home. We will protect our children from the heavy burden and toll of perpetual war. And we will honor the sacrifices made in service to peace and stability in Afghanistan, Iraq, and around the world.
Miller was appointed acting Secretary of Defense by President Donald Trump on November 9th after the president announced on Twitter that his predecessor, Mark Esper, had been fired. Miller spent 30 years in the military, starting as an enlisted soldier in 1983 and joining the U.S. Army Special Forces in 1993. He served in Afghanistan and Iraq and spent the last few years of his career at the Pentagon. It was a busy day in court Tuesday for the president's lawyers, with the cases seeking to overturn the announced results that former Vice President Joe Biden won the presidential election earlier this month. Presidential attorney and former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, Rudy Giuliani, was pleading a case in front of a federal court in Pennsylvania before Judge Matthew W. Brand, and was involved, according to news reports, in some very terse exchanges with the judge. Judge Brand was appointed by Barack Obama. Elsewhere, a state appellate court in Pennsylvania reversed the lower court finding for the president regarding the denial of access to the president's observers for ballot counting. That case will most likely be sent now to federal court and perhaps ultimately be reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court. It could also be remanded back to state court for further consideration. Elsewhere, cases in Michigan, Nevada, Arizona, and Wisconsin remain active, and a second trove of votes in Georgia that was discovered of voters who had previously voted in a Republican primary and were shown, according to records, to have not voted. It will require a recertification of that state's vote. This is the second such trove discovered in the last few days and may well result in litigation over the outcome in that state. And to discuss all of it, we go to Philadelphia to speak with our political advisor and consigliere, Professor Tony Montero. So it's still a slugfest, and it looks like it's going to be like that for some time. And despite what comes pouring out of your TV set, there's no certainty whatsoever over who's going to have their hand on that Bible on January 20th in the freezing cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like that. And, you know, on the one side, the corporate media, the mainstream media, and all of the talking heads are trying to make it look like Biden is the bringing the country back to normalcy and bringing legitimacy back to the presidency, and Donald Trump is abnormal and illegitimate. And of course, they've been arguing this for now 4 years, and they're extending this. But I agree with you that the country is deeply divided, and the courts maybe will provide remedies. I'm not convinced. I'm of the opinion that there are people who want to keep this as far away from the U.S. Supreme Court as possible, and there are people on the U.S. Supreme Court who would prefer not to deal with this because of the political ramifications and also the constitutional ramifications of apropos an election that was highly unusual, 100 million people voting before Election Day and 65 million people voting by universal mail-in ballots, we assume now, before Election Day. So there are a lot of questions, unusual questions, that going forward, the courts and the political parties will have to deal with. We're where we are in a lot of ways in 2016, 2017, when Trump is inaugurated. A divided country, what looks like a political stalemate. I would say the only difference, perhaps, is that, maybe not the only, but a big difference is that the Democratic Party is fragmenting and maybe falling apart in the face of the fact that the predicted blue wave did not happen.
That's true. And also, you could probably predict, and you can see the fissures on a daily basis almost, the same for the Republican Party, which, as a matter of fact, really, you know, came through 2016 that way. The Trump was not the machine candidate. He was not Jeb Bush. He didn't have, you know, $200 gazillion from the institutions, from the party, from all the party fundraisers and all of that. And, you know, if you go back to the original statements, most of the now members of the Senate and House Republicans made about Trump during the primaries, you can see where the outline of that fracture might be. Ted Cruz, one notable example, but there were, you know, dozens of them. And we're coming to a point over this. You know, this is clearly a struggle between institutional power and Trump, essentially, and whatever forces are allied with him. Meaning also, by the way, if it matters to anyone, a good portion of the people. I mean, in this, he represents the people against institutional power, as odd as that might seem to some folks. And when you have, the Republican and Democratic establishment siding, deciding which side to choose up on, they're thinking past the outcome. Okay, well, I'm a politician in the Senate. Trump loses, institutional power wins. What happens at my next primary?
That's the big question.
Yeah.
You know, because Trump is a phenomenon. Trump, the name Trump, is associated with a movement, not with a party. That's the difficult thing for people who are looking for low-hanging fruit and easy explanations. That's a hard thing for people to get their heads around. The Republican Party, let me put it this way, the Republican Party, whatever that is and can become after Trump, have an identity crisis. Now, you know, on this question of war and peace and withdrawing troops from Afghanistan and Iraq, of course, Trump wanted them all out by Christmas. He couldn't get it. But now, with Mitch McConnell feeling his oats a bit, and maybe Lindsey Graham, and of course, Mitt Romney, not to mention the entirety of the neocons, the war party, who are now in the Democratic Party, well, they're all against this withdrawal. But isn't that what Trump came into office saying? Isn't that what he said at the Republican Party convention in Cleveland, Ohio in 2016? And Don, isn't that what we, you and I, have been arguing all of this time? the withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan, the potential withdrawal from NATO completely. This overrides almost everything else. And if you want to be for real about it, this is why he is seen as the enemy of American empire and of the American ruling class itself. Oh. And this is why we had the election that we had. And this is why we are in the situation we're in now, which is a constitutional crisis of historic proportions.
Pelosi, okay, a perfect example, yesterday. The tactic they're taking, they put Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, out front, you know, which is perfect after what you just said, especially reminding us that, you know, one of Trump's opening barrages in the campaign was, hey, let's get rid of NATO. It's useless. It's done.
So they pushed Stoltenberg
out there saying that, you know, hey, you cannot pull out of Afghanistan and Iraq without coordinating with us. And so now Pelosi's concern is that Trump is doing this without consulting with NATO, not that he's doing it, because she can't, of course, say I'm opposed to pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan and then go back into San Francisco and run for office. I mean, even the base, Democratic base there couldn't laughingly sell her to Democratic voters if she came out that way. So instead, it's over process. Yes, we should get, it's assumed, yes, we should get out of Afghanistan. It's only been 19 years, but not this way.
Yeah. And you know, Trump had the courage to bring that issue to a head. And he did it as early as the convention, probably the primaries, in 2016. Now, the behavior of a fascist, taking the language of a certain part of the left, or most of what goes for the left. I thought that the classic definition of fascism is the most warlike, repressive elements of the ruling class. I mean, if Twitter can shut the president of the United States down and not the opposite, that would suggest that Trump does not have and probably never had the type of authoritarian power that goes with the definition of fascism. And if the the question is white supremacy, how do you explain that the majority of the American people, be they Democrat, Republican, independent, or not interested, are for an end to wars of regime change that the United States has been involved in, well, 19 years, if you take the invasion of Afghanistan, but longer than that, going back to the Clinton administration, how do you explain that the majority of people overwhelmingly are against these wars and the wealth of the nation, which was wasted up to $7 trillion, on these stupid wars and all of the human suffering that was brought to the peoples of Libya and Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, as a consequence of this. This is a moment of truth, I think, especially for the left, who disgraced themselves morally and politically in this last election.
Yeah, I mean, I really like to hear from loudly at the top of their lungs the people who are the leaders, quote unquote, of the anti-war movement, quote unquote. Now, on this, on Trump offering to do this without couching it in, we don't like Trump, but, or you can't believe this guy because he's a big liar, but, or anything else, but the president of the United States is pulling the troops out except for 2,500, and it's only because he can't do that politically unless you get more support for him. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that? and not have them qualify. GOT could be good with everything that I just gave before it and whatever else they can conjure up as a qualifier politically. I mean, I don't know where's the, all the people that invoke Martin Luther King all the time, let alone Malcolm X, okay? Yeah, you know, practically over lunch, you know, for instead of grace. That be talking about, you know, silence and, you know, deadly and courage and, you know, all of that stuff. Can't utter words because it's impolitical, you know, on issues like this. You know, there's things that, because it's not discussed, people don't. Last year, I think, I had an ad on Facebook in my feed. Some piece of electronic equipment captured my interest, $99. I went to it, bought it. That was the last I heard of my $99 or that firm or anything else. And I went to Facebook for help, and there was nothing. Now, I have never seen on an ad on Facebook, this guy might be a crook, or that there's information about this, you know, testosterone booster that doctors may disagree, or anything like that, that they put on the political speech coming out of people's mouths and just out of the words of the President of the United States. And why is it that it's political speech that is so dangerous and warrants this and is so essential that it be, you know, monitored and corrected, quote unquote, but they could tell you to take these pills, you know, that maybe like ground up goat butt or whatever, and not have like a doctor's opinion and maybe a paper or two on it accompanying the sale.
Yeah. No, it to me, Don, you know, by the way, the fact that in talking about these topics, these political topics, everything has to have a quote unquote around it. It says something about the moment and the ironies and ambiguities of the situation. So very few things are as they appear to be. That if you really want to know, you have to go below the appearances, which is below the propaganda. If war and peace and the American empire and U.S. imperialism should be at the top of the politics of any left in the most lethal, dangerous country that humanity has ever seen, given the weapons and the 800 military bases, if that should be our central priority rather than identity politics, why then have we, and when I say we, I'm talking about the broad progressive, the broad left, however it is defined, why have we not made war and peace a central priority? Are we willing to live with the suffering of people in the Arab world and the Muslim world and the non-European world because they're not white?
Okay,
have those let me make this point.
Go ahead.
Have those who claim their major platform as being the fight against white supremacy and for Black Lives Matter able to live with the murders and bombing and suffering of hundreds of millions of people because they are not European and because they are not white? So what does that say about the fight against white supremacy that ends at the borders of the United States? It is disingenuous.
And this is something that's been going on, it's always been going on, but it's been obvious at the center of the left, at least since the Russian Revolution, and perhaps earlier with Du Bois discussing it. Why is it that the third world, quote unquote, the agricultural and mineral source nations, the most backward among us, quote unquote, are backward? Mm-hmm. Instead of like going to lead the working class, because they're the most working class that we have, out of this mess. And that's what your piece in blackagendareport.com this week about Lenin and Du Bois on class struggle and civilization, I think is a must read to understand this moment on this point, that you can't say, hey, look, we're going to get back Pell Grants and more money at school lunches and stuff. And so I don't care if they bomb Africa or Latin America or anything else. Solidarity forever, by the way. And that you can't abandon the working class around the world and expect that you're going to be moving some revolution forward. I don't know what you'd call that, but it's not a workers' revolution that you're moving forward.
Mm-mm. No. And you know, you mentioned the article in the Black Agenda report. And, you know, the whole point of that article, or at least one of the points, is to argue against the claim of the left, of most of the left, the non-working class left, which is the left, that the American working class, especially white workers, are irredeemably backward. And therefore, rather than a class struggle approach to change, what they're talking about is more or less an identity politics and a cultural politics approach to change. Now, Lenin and Du Bois, interestingly, were on the same page on the question of how the backward, quote unquote, given the right conditions. For Lenin, it was the World War I. They were catapulted objectively into the vanguard of the struggle for socialism, going beyond the German working class that was better organized, more literate. So the backward became the vanguard, and in so doing, create a new human civilization, a new culture of working people. Du Bois said something very, very similar when he talked about the former slaves who he called the black working class, who were considered backward. But suddenly, as a result of the Civil War and going forward, are catapulted into the vanguard of the class conflict. And Du Bois makes the civilizational argument similar to Lenin's argument that in so doing, they create a framework, the backward that is, with quotes around it, create a framework not only for the class struggle going forward, but also for new civilization. My argument is that all of the arguments about backwardness of the working class, backwardness of peoples of color around the world, now that argument has come home to roost.
That's right.
And is being used against the U.S. working class, the so-called basket of deplorables.
You know, what's interesting, there's so many nested contradictions here. one of them is that for all of the claim by the identitarians, maybe to call them that, you know, and certainly in the left, the understanding for decades that the working class will be led most likely by working class members of color, and particularly black working class workers in the United States, because of the history here, that actually starts to germinate in a Marxist tradition with Du Bois. I mean, yeah. You know, they're claiming heritage to him, but that's not his point. That's just that's his observation of that moment. And now the ones that have no jobs, drug addicted, rusty cities around them or whatever, you know, some of them are there, but there's other people populating that place too.
Yeah. And see, you know, when you look at the dichotomy of 2020, the Democratic Party is without question the party of obscene wealth, of the military-industrial complex, of the national security state, and of the big media, high-tech and traditional corporate media.
Right.
I mean, is there any question about it? Now, a lot of people on the left will say, well, we joined with them in a temporary alliance against fascism,
yeah,
and the fascist is Trump. Now, That's a joke.
Right.
If Trump is the fascist, like I said before, why can Twitter shut him down and he can't shut them down?
Right. Who's Goebbels in here and which side is he on?
Can we talk, you know?
Yeah. You made some really good points in this essay, I'd like to really suggest blackagendareport.com. This is Professor Montero's essay this week there. V.I. Lenin and W.E.B. Du Bois, Class Struggle and Civilization. This is a central problem that we have, like, even going back to 1917. You know, Lenin is arguing with people like Trotsky that, look, we aren't going to win this revolution, this fight. We're in a battle. It's a military operation. It's a war. There are battlefield rules, and if you don't adhere to them, you lose. And so, looking at the landscape, he says, we need the peasants on our side, and they're willing to join, and it's in their interests, and they're workers, by the way. Mm-hmm. And Trotsky and others are saying, no, it must be industrial workers. Those are the most backward in the countryside, the peasantry. They're ignorant. They have no education. They're superstitious. They're reactionary, et cetera, et cetera. And we find out, of course, that when you have an alliance of workers and peasants, you win. So that becomes the great sin.
Yeah. And see, the other great sin is that Lenin would not bow down to the German Social Democrats, huge party, this prestigious party and their leadership of unions. He would not. In fact, he criticized them. And he ultimately argues, and this is the civilizational option as well, that rather than look to the West, Western Europe, for solidarity, we will look to Asia, China, and India. Because, of course, Russia is territorially majority Asian, part of Asia.
Right.
And so to look to Asia and thus to renounce the heritage of social democracy, which saw the workers of the colonial areas of the world as backward.
Yep.
Just in the same way that they saw the Russian workers as backward.
Yep.
I am making an argument against the inherent assumption of the politics of the left that the working class in the United States is backward. And it's not just white workers, they target white workers, but it is the entirety of the working class. And I'm arguing against that and asking the question, can a working class left be built out of what we have today? I pretty much say no. But a working class left can be built out of the oppositional forces who are standing up in the main against these wars in the Middle East, against these trade agreements that take jobs away from people, against the deindustrialized and low-wage economy that favors high-tech and Wall Street. From those forces, the possibility of a real left anchored to the working class is possible. And for the rest of them, let them go about their merry way. Most of them will end up as either university professors or lawyers and executives in some of the big high-tech corporations that have billions of dollars to shower upon them.
Professor Montero, thank you, as always, for your words of wisdom.
Thank you so much, Don. It's always a huge pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.